The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the November 18th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's political revolution. What happened? In one of the most stunning upsets in American political history, Republican nominee Donald Trump this week squeaked past Democratic opponent Hillary Clinton to be elected the 45th U.S. president. The billionaire businessman, who was written off by almost every pundit going into Election Day, secured at least 290 Electoral College votes, 20 more than required to win, despite narrowly losing the popular vote to Clinton, 47.7 to 47.5%, according to incomplete vote totals. The Republican nominee had been widely expected to lose, with aggregate polls showing him trailing Clinton by 3 points on Election Day. He is the oldest ever president-elect and the first never to have held elected political office or served in the military. In a conciliatory victory speech, Trump praised his opponent for her service to our country, promised to give every American the opportunity to realize his or her fullest potential, and pledged to unify the nation. "We will seek common ground," he said, "not hostility." Clinton told a crowd of somber and crying supporters that the loss was painful and urged them to keep fighting for their progressive principles. But she said the country owed the next president an open mind and a chance to lead. Trump's victory came as the result of a powerful surge of support from white and rural voters. He narrowly won the key battleground states of Florida and North Carolina before sweeping to victory with surprisingly easy wins in the Rust Belt states of Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. He won white voters 58% to 37%. Among the other swing states, Clinton won only Colorado, Nevada, and Virginia. Trump's victory triggered shockwaves around the world and sparked volatility in the financial markets. Russian President Vladimir Putin, who has been accused of meddling in the election, sent Trump a congratulatory telegram. What the editorial said: "Trump's momentous victory marks a thunderous repudiation of the status quo," said the Financial Times. "Not just of the remote and often robotic Hillary Clinton, but of President Obama, the liberal agenda, and the political establishment. Democrats may try to blame their repudiation on the late announcement by FBI Director James Comey that the agency was again examining Clinton's emails, but this populist rebellion against globalization, immigration, and free trade has been brewing since the global financial crisis exposed the profound fault lines in American society. Inequality has risen, and median incomes among less educated Americans have stagnated or fallen." What does a Trump presidency hold? "No one knows," said the New York Times. "He has yet to prove he has the capacity to focus on any issue, or indeed the temperament to govern a diverse nation of 320 million people, or control the largest nuclear arsenal in the world. But here's what we do know. Our next president is a man who threatens to prosecute his political opponents and curtail the freedom of the press, who lies without compunction and gleefully insults women, Muslims, and Hispanic immigrants, and who has promised to tear up vital deals on climate change and Iran's now mothballed nuclear program. And he has done all this with the loud support of racist, white supremacists, and anti-Semites." Voters understood the choice, said the Wall Street Journal. Clearly, enough of them were so dissatisfied with the Washington establishment and economic stagnation that they were willing to take a risk on Trump's unusual political profile and volatile temperament. Trump's victory is astonishing, especially given Clinton's huge advantages in fundraising and get-out-the-vote operations. And in a democracy, the voter sentiment that propelled him into office is one the whole country must respect. What the columnist said, "It's hard to overstate just how badly Democrats screwed this up," said Jim Newell in Slate.com. "They worked giddily to nominate Clinton, a total misfit for the anti-establishment mood of 2016, and insisted she could escape her baggage. Then they assured us that the firewall of blue Rust Belt states couldn't be breached, that their ground game was unbeatable. They were wrong on every count, and the Democratic Party now lies in shambles. Trump won because he gave voice to voters who have been ignored by GOP leaders for decades," said Charles Hurt in the Washington Times. "He and his supporters have torn away the facade of political correctness and transformed the party's positions on immigration, trade, and national security. Welcome, Democrats, to the revolution." "The revolution was fueled by overt racism," said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. "And Trump won because he represented a restoration of white authority. With his sneering attacks on immigrants, Muslims, and Black Lives Matter protesters, and his winks to the white nationalist, he united the white vote, working class and college educated, young and old, rich and poor. After 8 years of a black president, white Americans wanted their country back. This is now Trump's America," said Andrew Sullivan in NYMag.com. "He has full control of Congress and the chance to shift the Supreme Court to the far right for more than a generation to come." Trump's election is the most momentous shift in American political and cultural life in our time, said John Podhoretz in the New York Post. "He's tapped into a deep well of resentment, and his authoritarian instincts, his amorality, and impulsive decision-making are disturbing. But make no mistake, this is the opening chapter in a new age of American history." And a second main story, marijuana reform wins big in ballot initiatives. What happened? Marijuana advocates won major victories in ballot initiatives across the country as voters in California, Massachusetts, and Nevada this week voted to legalize the recreational use of the drug, while Arkansas, Florida, and North Dakota approved medical marijuana. Arizona rejected a proposal on recreational weed, and a vote in Maine was too close to call. Together, the results were the nearest the U.S. has come to a national referendum on marijuana, which remains illegal for all uses under federal law. These votes send a clear message to federal officials that it's time to stop arresting and incarcerating marijuana users, said Rob Campia, head of the Marijuana Policy Project Advocacy Group. Tougher gun control was on the ballot in four states. Voters in California approved a proposition that will outlaw high-capacity magazines and require background checks to buy bullets. Washington State voted to give authorities the power to temporarily seize firearms with a court order from people deemed a threat. A proposal requiring universal background checks for private firearm sales was approved in Nevada and narrowly voted down in Maine. California rejected an initiative that would have abolished its death penalty, but passed a proposition to expedite executions by speeding up appeals. Four states approved minimum wage hikes. Washington will raise its minimum wage from $9.47 to $13.50 an hour by 2020. Raises to $12 will be implemented in Arizona, Maine, and Colorado, which also became the sixth state to authorize physicians to assist in the voluntary death of terminally ill patients. What the columnist said, "It was the biggest year for ballot initiatives in a decade," said Lorraine Wohlert in Politico.com. In all, residents in 35 states sidestepped their elected officials to put 162 policy decisions directly to voters. That surge was in part a product of the same popular discontent that powered Donald Trump's outsider campaign. Fed up with political gridlock in Washington, D.C., activists and businesses took control of the policymaking process and forced hot topic issues onto the ballot. This election could go down as a watershed moment in the legalization of weed, said Katie Steinmetz in Time.com. More than half of the states now have comprehensive medical marijuana laws on the books, and roughly one-fifth of the population lives in a place where over 21s can legally consume weed for fun. And as big states like California embrace legal pot, pressure will increase on Congress to stop looking the other way and get proactive on drug reform, perhaps by rescheduling marijuana as a substance with known medical uses. President Trump might kill that high, said Christopher Ingraham in the Washington Post. Under President Obama, federal authorities have had a largely hands-off policy towards state-level marijuana legalization efforts. But the incoming Republican administration could easily reverse that approach, especially because Trump's most likely appointees to senior Justice Department positions, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, are no friends of marijuana reform. And our controversy of the week, President Trump, how will he govern? With the election of Donald Trump as our 45th president, big changes are on the way for America, and soon, said Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com. On January 20th, the presidency, the House, and the Senate will all be in GOP hands, enabling a policy revolution more dramatic than any we've seen since Ronald Reagan's first year in office. Expect a huge tax cut for the wealthy, the decimation of the low-income safety net, a big increase in defense spending, and a major deregulation of U.S. business. With total power to shape the agenda, said Jordan Weitzman in Slate.com, Republicans will seek a complete erasure of the Obama era. The Affordable Care Act, first and foremost, is now in deep danger, and with it, the health care coverage of some 20 million newly insured Americans, as well as every American with a pre-existing condition. Trump has vowed to kill the Dodd-Frank banking reforms and Obama's Clean Power Plan, designed to restrict carbon emissions and fight climate change. Trump, House Speaker Paul Ryan, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell may have had their differences over the course of this wild campaign season, but they share a desire to blot out the past 8 years. They are about to begin a truly radical experiment in conservative government. Trump will also alter the basics of U.S. foreign policy, said David Ignatius in WashingtonPost.com. He has threatened to rip up the nuclear deal with Iran and seems certain to try to improve relations with a combative, assertive Russia, and perhaps team up with Russia to attack ISIS in Syria. Putin has designs on Eastern Europe as well as the Middle East, said Michael Crowley in Politico.com. And he will have been emboldened by Trump's suggestion that he might leave NATO states to defend themselves. Much will depend on whom Trump chooses to advise him on foreign policy and whether they can help mitigate his most dangerous impulses. His impulses on trade are no less dangerous, said Ann Applebaum in WashingtonPost.com. The Trans-Pacific Partnership deal is now almost certainly dead in the water, and we have to assume that the North American Free Trade Agreement will unravel as well. And with it, the shared political and economic interests that bonded us to Canada and Mexico. For better or worse, that's clearly what voters wanted for the nation's next chapter, said Peter Baker in NYTimes.com. They've chosen a president who's vowed to do what's good for America, militarily and economically, even if the rest of the world might not like it. Campaign rhetoric is one thing, said Richard Painter, also in NYTimes.com. But as a self-interested businessman, Trump will soon realize that most of the things he promised to do in order to get elected make no sense. He probably won't start a trade war because it would cost the U.S. jobs, and he probably won't build an expensive wall at the Mexican border. He'll also find out that his outlandish promise to deport illegal immigrants en masse would not only create great social unrest, but also devastate the U.S. economy. America will be fine if President Trump runs the country in the same practical, if far from perfect, manner that he has run his businesses. We have never elected a president less prepared or temperamentally suited to the office than Trump, said Ross Douthat and NYTimes.com. Let's hope that the same crude genius that put him in the White House against all the odds can actually be turned somehow to the common good. And here we are with our good week, bad week shorts. Let's see what we've got. It was a good week for professional courtesy. After police issued NASCAR driver Dale Earnhardt Jr. a warning for speeding on his way to watch a race at the Texas Motor Speedway. When asked how fast he was going, Earnhardt replied, "Not fast enough." It was a good week for the good old days after a Boston University study found that medieval peasants in the 13th century Europe typically took 150 days off from work per year to celebrate holidays and other festivals. In 2015, the average American had just 16.2 vacation days. And it was a good week for Canada. After Donald Trump's victory sparked so much traffic to the country's immigration website that it crashed for hours. Online, searches for Canada and move to Canada soared into the millions. But it was a bad week for Hollywood, which issued a flood of despairing tweets over Donald Trump's victory. "About to throw up," actor Billy Eichner posted. "Xanax," tweeted Mita Farrow. Ellen producer Andy Lastner posted, "I'm on hold with Air Canada." It was a bad week for acting like a jerk after French researchers revealed that poor driving habits run in families, with 75% of motorists who admitted to experiencing road rage saying that they had witnessed their parents hurling insults from behind the wheel. And it was a bad week for divine intervention after a Buffalo woman filed a federal lawsuit to stop last week's presidential election because both candidates' character fell far below a presidential standard. Louise Nolly said she got an okay from God to try to save the country. On the briefing page now, titled "Extreme Weather, the New Normal." Massive floods, prolonged heat waves, and destructive storms are becoming more common. Why? How frequent are these events? This year, the U.S. had $12 billion disaster events. Floods, wildfires, hurricanes, severe storms, and droughts that each caused more than $1 billion worth of damage. Adjusted for inflation, there were on average only about two such events a year in the 1980s, 5 a year in the 1990s and 2000s, and almost 11 a year between 2010 and 2015. The flooding in Louisiana in August was the country's eighth once-in-every 500 years weather event in a little over 12 months. Wildfires in California and other parts of the West grew at a rate of 90,000 acres a year between 1984 and 2011. In Alaska, four of the 10 worst fire seasons on record have occurred since 2004. The UN has calculated that the number of severe storms, floods, and heat waves worldwide is five times greater than it was in 1970. The World Bank estimates that extreme weather today affects 170 million people a year, up from 60 million three decades ago. The weather has changed, said Miles Allen, head of the Climate Dynamics Group at Oxford University. Normal weather, unchanged over generations apart from random fluctuations, is a thing of the past. Why is this happening? Most atmospheric scientists say it's the result of climate change, which is now well underway. 2014 was the hottest year on record, but it was surpassed by 2015. 2016 has been hotter still, with an average temperature about 2.25 degrees Fahrenheit above the late 19th century average. While it's impossible to isolate and identify the cause of an individual storm or heat wave, the warming of the planet has almost certainly made extreme weather events much more likely. Warmer air absorbs more moisture. In wetter climates, that leads to bigger storms and floods. In drier areas, where there is little water to absorb, the higher temperatures exacerbate droughts. Mild winters produce less snowpack, leaving soil and forests parched and susceptible to wildfires in summer. Higher ocean temperatures provide more energy to hurricanes. An in-depth study of extreme weather by the insurance company Munich Re concluded that climate change is the only plausible explanation for the rise in weather-related catastrophes. Which areas are worst afflicted? Different regions face different challenges. Tropical storms in Florida and the rest of the Southeast, severe winters in the Northeast, tornadoes, floods, and hailstorms in the South and Midwest, droughts and wildfires in the West. It is the same around the world. Australia mostly struggles with heat waves of plus 100 degree temperatures and roaring wildfires. South America has been battered by severe storms. Europe has suffered from prolonged rainstorms that led to devastating floods. These weather events aren't just becoming more common, they're also becoming more powerful. The heaviest storms in the Southeast dump 27% more rain per event than they did in the 1950s. Hurricane Matthew, which caused widespread damage in the Carolinas in October, dumped a staggering 14 trillion gallons of water on the Southeast, 1% of the rainfall the entire country receives over the course of a whole year. How are people affected? Lives are lost and a vast amount of property is destroyed. Extreme weather kills more than 500 Americans each year. The Louisiana floods, which saw 2 feet of rain fall in 48 hours in some areas, damaged 60,000 properties, costing an estimated $30 billion. Most Americans simply can't afford to rebuild after a natural disaster. The Federal Emergency Management Agency provides up to $30,000 to badly affected households, but that's not enough to fully repair the damage in many cases. In the rest of the world, extreme weather tends to cause less monetary damage, but more fatalities. A 2003 heat wave in Europe, where air conditioning is less commonplace, caused 70,000 premature deaths. Severe droughts can cause sharp rises in food prices. In undeveloped nations, flooding can spread disease and trigger epidemics. Will it get worse? Undoubtedly. How much worse depends on how much the world curbs carbon emissions. One study estimates that if greenhouse gas emissions continue unabated, areas of the Persian Gulf and Southeast Asia will experience heat waves with temperatures so extreme, in excess of 120 degrees, that as little as 6 hours exposure could be fatal. Another study concluded that by 2045, cities on the East and Gulf Coast will experience 10 times as many tidal floods, which will roll farther inland and last longer. The existing disaster plans of local, state, and federal governments are simply not designed for extreme weather events of this magnitude. A lot of communities, a lot of cities, a lot of human settlements in general were designed to reflect the climate of the past, said Gavin Smith, director of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Coastal Resilience Center of Excellence. We've designed cities to reflect a previous climate. Read a few of the columns now, two from the U.S. The first, spare us the partisan analysts. CNN was right to dump Donna Brazile, and it should keep going, said Jack Schaefer. Last week, the network fired the interim chair of the Democratic National Committee from its roster of on-camera contributors after hacked emails revealed Brazile had fed questions to the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign before two CNN primary debates. That naked partisanship was unforgivable. But the real problem is the whole ecosystem of paid partisan yakkers who now populate cable news shows. Former politicians and political consultants such as James Carville, Paul Begala, Mike Huckabee, Corey Lewandowski, and other political hacks are supposedly paid by the networks to provide insight and the illusion of impartiality. The shallow, predictable punditry these paid shills provide isn't journalism. Since Brazile, Lewandowski et al. Remain loyal to their primary employers, the Democratic and Republican parties. Did CNN really think that the elementary concepts of journalistic fairness would govern Brazil's conduct? It would make more sense for those networks to pay actual journalists to ask tough questions of party surrogates and stop blurring the line between legitimate journalistic analysis and partisan advocacy. Redefining do no harm. A patient recently implored me, "If my heart stops, doctor, just let me go," said physician Haider Haved Warek. When I asked why, he replied, "Because there are worse states than death." Indeed, while medical advances offer immense benefits and have extended human life, they have also changed death into dying, transforming terminal illness into long, anguished months or years of disability and pain. For good reason, many patients now fear prolonged hospital treatment more than death itself. That's why Colorado this week joined five other states and the District of Columbia in legalizing physician-assisted suicide, even as the group most vehemently opposed to it hasn't budged. Doctors. Doctors' resistance is grounded in the Hippocratic Oath, which tells us, do no harm. But modern doctors must reassess what this means. Isn't it harmful to subject dying patients to invasive treatments and artificial life support that cannot save them and can only prolong their suffering? With strict safeguards in place, assisted suicide can help give terminally ill patients a semblance of control over their lives as disease, disability, and the medical machine try to wrest it away from them. And the international column, this is how they see us. President Trump versus the world. Russia's parliament erupted in cheers at the news of Donald Trump's victory this week, and leaders of Europe's far-right parties celebrated in exultant tweets, seeing Trump's win as a triumph for their anti-immigration movements. Elsewhere, the news was greeted with dismay. Gerard Araud, French ambassador to the U.S., declared that the world was collapsing before our eyes. European leaders offered their customary congratulations to the president-elect, with both German Chancellor Angela Merkel and British Prime Minister Theresa May emphasizing their nation's close ties to the U.S. Yet behind the scenes, America's partners are panicking because they do not know what is going to happen to them. The U.S. has undergone a populist and economic nationalist insurrection. And the candidate who lambasted NATO and other U.S. obligations throughout the campaign is now leader of the West. Trump's presidency will dramatically redefine international power structures, said Anna Caldwell in the Daily Telegraph. Japan, South Korea, and the Baltic nations will have to reconsider their defense strategies because Trump has warned that they may not be able to count on U.S. assistance in the event of war. China and Russia, meanwhile, will both be considering how far they can push their power. Russia should celebrate, said Alexander Rahr. Trump has promised to work with us for better relations. We foresee the removal of U.S. missile defense systems from Eastern Europe, and the Poles and the Baltic states will have to turn tail and adapt. Ukraine, which was hoping for weapons from President Clinton, will instead have to make peace with its breakaway eastern regions. We can also expect Trump to pressure Europe to lift the onerous sanctions it placed on Russia after the 2014 annexation of Crimea. For China, the Trump presidency is uncharted territory, said the Global Times in an editorial. During the campaign, Trump repeatedly promised to raise tariffs on imported Chinese goods and to spark a trade war. Yet he may not be bold enough to make good on his threats. He will surely try to be tough on China, but he should be aware that China will always defend its own interests with strength. If Trump wants to target bilateral trade, he should first weigh the consequences of China's countermeasures. The people have chosen the path of racism, hatred, and intolerance, said El Universal from Mexico in an editorial. During Trump's vicious campaign, Mexico and Mexicans were his punching bags, and nothing good can be expected during his administration for the millions of Mexican nationals who live in the U.S. Those who supported Trump, a bare half of Americans who voted, long to return the U.S. to the days of white supremacy. We can only hope they fail. Now more than ever, the rest of the world must stand as a dam against the coming flood of ugliness. And we're on the last word now, our in-depth article. Inside Trump's improbable win. Donald Trump's campaign was often riven by division and confusion, but in the end, he listened mostly to himself, said journalist Alex Eisenstadt, Eli Stokols, Shane Goldmacher, and Kenneth Vogel. It was Friday afternoon, an hour after America heard Donald Trump bragging on tape about sexually assaulting women, when Roger Stone's phone rang. A secretary in Trump's office had an urgent request. The GOP nominee wanted the political dark arts operative to rescind a confidential memo he had penned less than 2 weeks earlier. It was a one-page guide on Stone's favorite line of attack against the Democratic nominee. How to savage Hillary Clinton for Bill Clinton's history with other women. It was a political third rail for most conventional candidates, a tactic that Republicans had tested and deemed a failure, and an approach so ugly that even the Clintons' most vocal detractors urged Trump against it. But the GOP nominee, recognizing his crude, abusive comments caught on an Access Hollywood tape as a potential campaign ender, needed no convincing. He decided it was time to return fire. Hillary has bullied, attacked, shamed, and intimidated his victims, Trump said in an apology just after midnight, quoting the Stone memo almost verbatim. And 2 days later, 90 minutes before the debate, he followed Stone's advice and brought Bill Clinton's accusers to a surprise press conference and then to the debate to confront the former president in person. Trump's untraditional and unflinchingly shameless campaign was always an improvised TV drama. It was personality-driven, consumed with defending the candidate's manhood and gratifying his ego, uninterested in the less glamorous work of building a professional campaign infrastructure, undeterred by the candidate's troublesome past, and unwilling to adopt a message the GOP establishment swore he needed. And yet, he won. But not because this celebrity businessman and his team managed to eke some functionality out of the chaos. Indeed, his run looked like a train wreck, because it was. No, Donald Trump is now president-elect because his relentless, sometimes manic salesman's pitch was able to pluck a string with Americans that no poll really managed to capture. The perpetual belief that a new character with a new story could deliver them something nobody else could, whether a trade victory over China, or a wall against Mexicans, or a return to a vision of America that seemed to be vanishing for good. And the more he cut loose, the more the media covered him, and the more people he reached. In early June, the Republican National Convention, Trump's crowning, was right around the corner. It was a moment for the campaign to turn the corner, to focus on healing the wounds opened in the bitter Republican primary and moving together into a general election against a wounded Democratic nominee who was widely considered to be beatable. By mid-June, less than 1 month before the convention would be gaveled in, there was no program. No celebrity acts had been booked. No known GOP leaders or elders had asked for a speaking slot. Slots were ultimately filled with mostly B and C list celebrities and GOP officials. Those troubles, however, ranked below the drama unfolding around a speaking slot traditionally reserved for the final vanquished contender. On July 6, 2 weeks before the convention, Republican National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus met with Ted Cruz and the Texas Senator's top political advisor, Jeff Rowe. Priebus, eager for a show of unity in Cleveland, wanted Cruz, who had clashed bitterly with Trump, to speak. Cruz, who had proven himself over the course of 2016 an adept tactician, knew he had leverage and agreed to sit with Trump on Capitol Hill the next day. They met privately at the offices of the National Republican Senatorial Committee. Trump, who was with his daughter Ivanka, son-in-law Jared Kushner, and Priebus, spent 45 minutes talking with Cruz. He offered Cruz a speaking slot, which the senator accepted. But Trump, perhaps owing to his lack of political experience, neglected to ask for something more basic, Cruz's endorsement. The oversight set the stage for chaos in Cleveland. As the convention neared, the looming disaster never fully dawned on Trump Tower. They had been operating on the assumption that Cruz would offer his support, even though it had never been made explicit. It wasn't until the first day of the convention that the New Yorker called Cruz and finally asked him for an endorsement. The Texan said no. In his convention speech, Cruz urged Republicans to vote your conscience. A cascade of boos flooded the hall, but the damage was already done. Rather than helping to unify the Republican Party and rally the GOP for a fight against Hillary Clinton, Cruz smirked as he delivered a sucker punch that drove the most dominant storyline coming out of Cleveland. Trump's party still didn't like him, and things were about to get a whole lot worse. In the days after the convention, Trump endured a series of disastrous headlines, most of them surrounding his attacks on a Muslim Gold Star family that had shamed him from the Democratic National Committee stage. Priebus met with the nominee and told him he was hurting himself. Trump, deeply demoralized, was at one of the lowest points of the campaign. In August, Trump gathered a number of his top advisors in New York City for a presentation led by his chief pollster, Tony Fabrizio. The numbers showed Trump was falling behind in a number of states. The nominee was stunned by the numbers, but he didn't push back. "Jesus," he said, "can we come back from this?" Trump would often ask his team whether he could win. But the mood was different this time. His aides were struck by the feeling of helplessness that had overtaken a candidate whose public image was centered on his confidence. To some of them, it highlighted his political inexperience. Meanwhile, Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign chairman, was having problems of his own. He had suffered weeks of media scrutiny into his ties with Russian-linked oligarchs, and it was taking a toll. On August 18th, Manafort came to Trump's Alexandria, Virginia offices for a day of meetings. Manafort, who was routinely getting 3 hours of sleep a night, was exhausted and frustrated. At one point, he appeared to doze off. Later in the day, Manafort invited a few aides into an office. The coverage, which he felt to be deeply unfair, was never going to stop. "They're just going to keep beating the blank out of me until I can't take it anymore," he said. The next day, Manafort abruptly announced his resignation. And that's when the campaign started to turn around for Trump. Taking Manafort's place were two people who would let Trump be Trump. Stephen Bannon took over as campaign CEO, and the campaign manager would be Kellyanne Conway, a pollster who'd been brought on in June and who developed a chemistry with Trump, mainly by cloaking the difficult reality she delivered to the candidate in more optimistic terms. Trump's decision to elevate the two, especially Bannon, demonstrated that Trump wanted to end his campaign just as he'd begun it, as an unapologetic, bare-knuckled nationalist. Recommended to Trump at the urging of the GOP mega-donor Robert Mercer, Bannon oversaw the alt-right Breitbart website, which frequently takes on Republican establishment figures. Conway and Bannon took charge with the critical debate season just weeks away. While Clinton had been taking debate prep seriously, the far less disciplined Trump was doing little. His prep sessions, which included former Fox News chairman Roger Ailes, were unfocused affairs. David Bossie, the newly installed deputy campaign manager, was particularly frustrated that there wasn't a structured and more conventional approach. When Trump arrived at Hofstra University for the first debate on September 26, he was on edge. When he took the stage, he struggled to summon the usual rancor, delivering scattered, relatively subdued, and at times incoherent performances. But it didn't matter. The voters who would drive his election night win responded with cheers to his debate performance. They didn't flinch when he interrupted Clinton dozens of times or bristle when he couldn't answer substantive questions. He was speaking to his audience, and that's all he needed to do. Yet even in the final stretch, Trump's team remained divided about what his message should be. The campaign's internal surveys showed him behind in swing states like North Carolina and Florida, and also in traditionally conservative Georgia. And his pollsters argued that presenting Trump as a change figure was perhaps the only way to turn the tide. When the Access Hollywood tape hit, Trump recognized the peril it presented. Trump's campaign set in motion Stone's plan to bring Bill Clinton's accuser to the second debate. Here was perhaps the most explosive moment of the 2016 campaign. Trump ignoring all of the advice of veteran Republican leaders and strategists and instead adopting Stone's prescribed course, giving accusers of Bill Clinton, who was not running for president, a national platform to prosecute a case against the woman who was Hillary Clinton. When it was over, Clinton, controlled and stone-faced throughout the debate, was once again deemed to have won. And once again, it didn't matter to Trump's voters. And then 11 days before the election, Trump got a break he needed. The FBI director's stunning announcement that his bureau was reviewing new information in the Clinton email probe. A renewed sense of optimism rippled through the Trump ranks. Aides began openly discussing which jobs they might get in a Trump administration. And at the RNC, operatives said they detected a dramatic shift toward Trump among undecided and Republican voters who had been wary of the nominee. As Trump hit the final stretch and he searched for a narrow path to victory, his team decided on a gambit to try to steal a blue state from Clinton. Fabrizio suggested that Trump compete in Michigan and Minnesota. The odds were long. The RNC's predictive model on the Friday afternoon before the election had Trump losing all important Florida by 2 percentage points and finishing with 240 electoral votes, 30 short of the tally needed to win the presidency. Clearly, Republicans couldn't see victory on the horizon, but Trump didn't lose heart as he had in August. In the final days of the campaign, he nursed grudges and plotted revenge against those he felt had wronged him. At close to the top of the list was Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, who Trump was convinced seemed determined to undermine him at all costs. Trump's circle of advisors remained as elastic and unwieldy as ever. Aside from Stone, Bannon, and Conway, a figure from the past, Manafort, was back in the fold. The strategist was offering the GOP nominee pointers on how to handle the Clinton email news and urging him to make a play in Michigan. Former campaign manager Corey Lewandowski, too, would join Trump on the trail in New Hampshire. Priebus, meanwhile, had become a trusted member of the inner sanctum, all with the hope of holding his fragile party together and exerting a positive influence on his inexperienced, self-destructive nominee. Through a mix of chiding and cajoling, he'd succeeded in ways Manafort had not. And yet, Trump had always done it his way, on matters large and small. On the last Wednesday before Election Day, Priebus joined Trump on the nominee's 757 jet. With Trump settled into his leather armchair, the cabin TV set was tuned to CNN. Priebus suggested they flip over to catch Game 7 of the World Series. But Trump said no. He controlled the remote and was fixated on the image on the screen, a picture of himself. He wasn't about to start listening to GOP veterans now. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Politico magazine. I'm going to read one of the obituaries for you today. The prosecutor who became the U.S.'s top lawyer, Janet Reno, 1938 to 2016. Janet Reno once told reporters, "I don't do spin." She wasn't lying. In 1993, just 38 days after becoming the first female U.S. Attorney General, the former Florida prosecutor gave the go-ahead for a federal raid on the compound of a religious cult in Waco, Texas. A fire broke out during the assault that left nearly 80 people dead, a third of them children. Reno didn't try to deflect the blame. Telling reporters, "The buck stops with me," she publicly accepted full responsibility and offered President Bill Clinton her resignation. He refused, and Reno went on to become the longest-serving attorney general in more than a century. "My mother always told me to do my best," she said, "to think my best and to do right." Reno was born in Miami and grew up near the Everglades in a house her journalist mother built herself, said the New York Times. She studied at Cornell University and then Harvard Law School, graduating as one of just 16 women in a 500-strong class. After working at Miami law firms, Reno joined the state government in the early 1970s. and in 1978 became Florida's first female state attorney. She remained in the post through five election campaigns until 1993, when the White House called. As U.S. Attorney General, Reno brought a fierce independence to her job, said the Washington Post. Republicans criticized her for refusing to investigate Vice President Al Gore over campaign finance irregularities. Democrats attacked her for authorizing an investigation into President Clinton's affair with White House intern Monica Lewinsky. A self-described awkward old maid who never married, the 6'1" Reno was lampooned on Saturday Night Live in the skit Janet Reno's Dance Party, a send-up she embraced by appearing on the show. Reno's tenure ended as it began, with high drama, said the Miami Herald. In 2000, she controversially approved the armed seizure of Elion Gonzalez, a 6-year-old Cuban refugee who lived with relatives in Miami, but whose father wanted him to return to Cuba. Reno, who had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 1995, stepped down as U.S. Attorney General in 2001 and faded from the public eye after an unsuccessful run for Florida governor in 2002. "I've had a thoroughly good time," she once said of her career. "I've had the opportunity to serve my country, and it's been extraordinary." We're on the health and science page now. Signs of life in a flickering star. A mysterious star 1,500 light-years away has captivated astronomers, who suggest it just might be displaying signs of extraterrestrial life. So much so, in fact, that it's now a prime target of the Breakthrough Listen program, the $100 million alien hunting project backed by Stephen Hawking and Russian billionaire Yuri Milner. Yale researcher Tabitha Boylan last year observed a strange and unpredictable flickering in the star, formerly named KIC 8462852. Since dubbed Tabby Star in Boylan's honor, it has grown generally fainter over the past century, but also dims by up to 22% at irregular intervals. Astronomers have struggled to account for the phenomenon. A range of possibilities, say passing debris from a planetary-scale collision or a swarm of comets, can't fully explain it. And while distant stars do flicker when orbiting planets pass in front of them, even a Jupiter-sized gas giant would cause a dimming of only about 1%, and do so in a predictable pattern. Once one lingering hypothesis remains to be investigated. An alien megastructure composed of highly advanced solar energy panels is orbiting the star. To test this theory, the Breakthrough Listen program has trained several of the world's largest and most powerful radio telescopes on Tabby Star, hoping to detect an advanced civilization, reports Space.com. "I don't think it's very likely, a one in a billion chance of something like that," said Dave Wertheimer, chief scientist at the Berkeley SETI Center. "But nevertheless, we're going to check it out." A patch for peanut allergies. A new skin patch may help treat children and young adults with peanut allergies, which afflict some 3 million Americans, CNN reports. Known as epicutaneous immunotherapy, the patch releases peanut proteins into the skin to build up cellular tolerance for the nuts. Investigators from the Consortium of Food Allergy Research worked with 74 volunteers between ages 4 and 20, all of whom had a peanut allergy. The volunteers were randomly assigned to wear a high-dose patch, a low-dose patch, or a placebo. After a year, 46% of the low-dose group and 48% of the high-dose group could consume at least 10 times more peanut protein than they could when the study began, as opposed to only 12% of those on the placebo patch. Children ages 4 to 11 had the best response, while the patch had less effect on those ages 12 and older, study authors said. The patch could hopefully protect people accidentally exposed to peanuts and other foods, said Emory University allergy researcher Jennifer Shi, who wasn't involved in the study. But this is not so that somebody can eat a bunch of Reese's. And we have time for just a few short notes. North Carolina eliminated 27 polling places for this election and cut hours at other sites, producing long lines that required voters to wait hours. Other Republican-controlled states, freed of Voting Rights Act restrictions, also dramatically cut the number of polling places, including Texas, 403 poll closures, Louisiana, 103, Alabama, 66, and Arizona, which closed 140 of its 200 sites. American millennials are pushing global coffee demand to a new record high, sending prices soaring in the U.S.'s coffee houses. Young people now start drinking coffee at the average age of 14.7 years, and those ages 19 to 34 now account for about 44% of coffee drinking. As baby boomers age, the number of Americans 65 and older getting cosmetic surgery is rising. In 2015, eyelid surgeries rose 62% among seniors to 39,772 procedures, while facelifts doubled to 37,632 procedures. About 1.8 million U.S. children were homeschooled in 2012. 3.4% of the U.S. student population, and double the number since 1999. About 4 in 10 homeschoolers have parents who graduated college. 62% of Americans say they are less proud of the country due to the 2016 presidential race, while only 7% said the race made them more proud. And we'll finish with a quote from Dolly Parton. The bigger the hair, the closer to God. And on that note, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.